I've gone through about, well, I don't know, 6 or 7 different titles for the presentation this afternoon, so a little bit of drama and angst on my part, because media fluency is extremely difficult to get your head around. And what I would like to do is try to break your heads in the early going, try to bring some things back together and integrate them, but in challenging ways, in the midstream. A small excursion dedicated to Ed Webb, with whom I was tweeting just earlier today about the dangers of a particular description of generational differences, which I won't get to yet. And then at the end, maybe have a hopeful, rousing conclusion so you don't think all is lost. I ended up with a question mark after the title because I think there are a great number of uncertainties here as we proceed. This is part of the point. If we don't get our minds around the uncertainties and the difficulties connected with media fluency, we haven't really thought about it. And if we haven't really thought about it, well, the answer you get is only as good as the question you ask. So let's get to some questions. First, a little history. Some of you probably remember this. ACRL, information literacy. Here's the definition. Information literacy is a set of abilities requiring individuals to recognize when information is needed and have the ability to locate, evaluate, and use effectively the needed information. Sounds simple enough. I especially applaud the ACRL for avoiding the split infinitive, which they did there, as you can see. So this was a starting point. The idea is we must teach our students to be reliable and effective consumers of information. This idea is still floating around in the background as we think about media fluency. And I'd sort of like to kill it. I'd sort of like to drive a stake through its heart. Let's go from information literacy to digital fluency. The zombie still walks. Digital information fluency is the ability to find, evaluate, and use digital information effectively, efficiently, and ethically. Now we're thinking about IP and so forth because all the kids have learned how to rip their CDs. DIF involves internet search skills. I'm not going to read all this to you. It's the same thing. And you see a diagram like this. What information am I looking for? Where will I find the information? How will I get there? How good is the information? How will I ethically use the information? The question that's not asked, the question that's at the core of the move from literacy to fluency is how can I participate in the construction of knowledge ethically? How can I contribute to the discourse responsibly in an informed yet creative and insightful way? That idea seems to be very difficult for people to think about. It doesn't emerge in the conversation. Now, when you're talking about where to find information sources or how to use effective search strategies, you can almost live with that, though I'm still not good with it. When you get to media fluency, if you're on this level with the paradigm, you're in big trouble. Because really what you're doing is a kind of embedding images in Microsoft Word on steroids. That is not media fluency. I call this the media fluency epic fail department. Capture, edit, share images. Capture, edit, share audio. Capture, edit, share video. New software. New hardware. More workshops. Churn. And repeat. I saw a tweet just a few minutes ago from someone. I don't know if he's here or not, but it was very plaintive. He said, why is it that staff come to these workshops, but faculty don't? Now, there are a lot of reasons for that, including the fact that sometimes faculty believe they've done all the learning they need to do. I've actually had my colleagues tell me that. I think they're joking. Who knows? But I think the other reason has to do with this endless tech churn, which is a phrase that John Udell may not have made up, but he shared with me in some correspondence just a few weeks ago. If the idea is, well, you knew how to do this, now you need to know how to do that, now you need to use this to do this to do this, and now you're embedding, etc. Those are skills, but they're not getting at the core of media fluency. And I have some ideas about why they're not getting at the core idea. Because this is what we have to confront. And if we don't take the full measure of this statement, which I believe is a true statement, we are simply not facing the real world. Our students are. Sometimes they could use some guidance from us. But we're all hiding behind, well, not all of us, these are extreme statements, just to get you riled up. We're all hiding behind, how do you embed an image in the, and how, okay, no. We are living in the middle of the largest increase in expressive capability in the history of the human race. And even if Sturgeon's law holds true and 95% of this is crap too, that's okay. Have you looked at an airline magazine lately? That's not what I would call a really enlightened use of print technology. Doesn't matter. This increase in expressive capability is something we have to think about, not at the level of the tech churn, but what does it mean and what are the opportunities presented to us and what opportunities should we be sharing with our students? This transformation is typically spoken of in terms of the advent of print technology, which no one thinks of as technology, but it was quite disruptive for its day. Civil wars, regicide, massive increases in literacy, pretty much what we think of when we think of the modern liberal education curriculum, followed on the invention of movable type. I think what we're looking at is bigger than that, much bigger than that. When we think about media fluency, don't think about print. Think about the phonetic alphabet. That's huge. And it's hard to get your head around. It's an alphabet. What will you do with the alphabet? I don't know. What do you want to do with the alphabet? It's not just an object. It's an idea. It's a new medium of expression or a new set of potential media for expression. And this is complicated by the fact that I'm going to talk about the tools now. The tools we have for generating material in these new media are becoming extraordinarily powerful. They're everywhere. They're really small. If you want to keep up with this, take a look at a blog called Millicomputing. I recommend it highly. You know, we talk about mobile computing. This is mobile computing at the level of where are we going to be in 2 years, where are we going to be in 3 years in terms of what the platform will enable. This, I love this chip. It's the Cortex A9. If you have an iPhone or an iPod Touch, you've probably got a Cortex A8 in there, we think. Apple's notorious for not letting us know. This is the next generation. It's already in production. It's got four separate high-definition encoding-decoding units, four separate central processing units. That means you'll have in your pocket, consuming less than 1 watt, it won't burn your leg, a machine, a medium, a platform that's the equivalent of four Blu-ray recorders and playback units, four parallel processors, eventually built out, Adrian Cockcroft believes, to the extent that we'll have not just high-def video playback, but 10 times today's web surfing speed. And if you're watching Sprint with the 4G rollout, they're advertising mobile multiplayer gaming with a device that fits in your pocket over the 4G network. Even calling it a game changer doesn't work anymore. That's a paltry concept when it gets to that level. A 20 megapixel camera in your pocket. 130 hours of audio playback on a mobile device as the memory inside these devices increases. Cockcroft goes on to talk about the fact that we're not going to connect to the web with these devices. These devices will be web servers, and they will connect us wirelessly in whatever environment we happen to find ourselves by means of geolocation with all the peripherals we'll need. You go into your office, the device in your pocket serves your content up to the web and connects you wirelessly to your keyboard, your flat panel display, whatever it is you're going to be using. The scale of the question of media fluency is off the scale. And I think the only way we can have any hope of addressing this at all well is to think about this not as media fluency, but as medium fluency. Fluency with the idea of what a medium is. Or to put it another way, since these are digital devices, which have as their property being able to simulate other devices, these computers are meta media. And if we can think about them at that level, we can start to think about these possibilities a little more clearly, I think. and maybe get a better idea, and I'm a little fired up after Brian Hawkins this morning, so you just have to pardon me, maybe get the idea that tweaking business as usual is not going to be what we need to be doing. Personal Dynamic Media, an essay written by Alan Kay and Adele Goldberg, published in 1977. They were at Xerox PARC, Palo Alto Research Center, developing what has become notebook computing, which, of course, is the ancestor of the mobile computers we have in our pockets. And in 1977, here's how Alan Kay and Adele Goldberg tried to get their minds around this. The ability to simulate the details of any descriptive model means that the computer, viewed as a medium itself, can be all other media, if the embedding and viewing methods are sufficiently well provided. That's another way of saying, if you can truly think digitally, you won't be thinking just at the level of applications or whatever machine you happen to be using. You'll be thinking at the strategic level. The computer is a metamedium. Moreover, this new metamedium is active, Kay and Goldberg continue. It can respond to queries and experiments, so that the messages may involve the learner in a two-way conversation. We think the implications are vast and compelling. I think they're right. But I don't think we've come to grips with that yet in higher education. Or if we have, we keep taking two steps forward, one step back, one step to the side, and now what are we going to do with our labs? Let me get at this a little bit farther and maybe connect it to what we talk about when we talk about liberal education. Anybody here read this book by Douglas Hofstadter, Fluid Concepts and Creative Analogies? I recommend it to you highly. It's a book that, in some respects, is against the idea of artificial intelligence as something that machines will ever be able to simulate or stimulate. But looked at the other way, it's a book about the nature of intelligence, what we value beyond the specifics of domain knowledge as we manipulate these concepts. And it has, as a kind of an unintended consequence, ideas about how these metamedia, these computers we carry around, can actually assist us in coming up with fluid concepts and creative analogies, which Hofstadter calls the fundamental mechanisms of thought. Now you see, this is the break your head part. Media fluency is about the fundamental mechanisms of thought. That's my story. I'm sticking to it. Hofstadter writes, quote, "The most important factor that sets top-notch mathematicians apart from their peers is that after coming up with something new, rather than being concerned primarily with the question, how can I prove this result, they're concerned with questions like, how interesting is this idea? By fiddling around with it in various familiar ways, can I find ideas that are even more interesting? This is pattern play at a very high level, not so different from what a composer of music might do with a newly discovered theme that seems full of potential." Media fluency, or meta-media fluency, is about using computers to help us fiddle around with ideas fruitfully in interesting ways. That's how these things converge and become more than just another set of applications or machines. It's a trick that Hofstadter calls perceptual regrouping. He has a long excursion on this in the book, which I won't go through in any detail, but essentially he thinks about the way in which the way you group digits together can either obscure or reveal a pattern. And then he pops it up even another level with this famous psychological kind of figure ground exercise. This is called a Necker cube. How many of you have seen a Necker cube before? Okay, a number of you. And Hofstadter describes his own way of thinking about things, getting to these fluid concepts and creative analogies, as a Necker cube-like exercise in which, and here we go, you can either see the Necker cube as going back that way with this plane in the front, or you can flip it and see it coming out another way with this plane in the front. And with enough practice, you can switch back and forth. It's like that figure that was set around a few years ago where you can see the woman dancing in one direction or the other. You saw that, right? Hofstadter looks at this as a fundamental element of human intelligence, being able to see the thing and flip back and forth perceptually because of an ability he calls perceptual regrouping. And in many ways, that's what our brains are able to do to come up with new ideas and not simply repeat after me. The ability to come up with new ideas and not simply repeat after me, it seems to me, is at the core of liberal education. Though domain knowledge is important, of course, you have to know something, you have to know the alphabet before you can write. Still, the question of what to write, how to write, what elegant sentence you can construct is not just a question of knowing the alphabet. Similarly, media fluency is not just a question of, well, I could do Photoshop, now can I do this other thing? That's important. But above that is the question of, can I use this meta medium, these sets of media together, to be able to do perceptual regrouping, to be able to flip the cube back and forth and kickstart new ideas, these fluid concepts, these creative analogies. So, one early conclusion is that if we're serious about media fluency, we're going to have to rethink our signature pedagogies because they may not have the same force and value for integrative thinking, fluid concepts, creative analogies that they had when they were new. They may have ossified, or they may be necessary but not sufficient. And if we don't consider this well, we're going to be in the situation of continuing to rely on signature pedagogies that will end up where I got this image, which is a term paper mill, where the student, who according to the website has better things to do with his or her time, purchases the simulation of fluency. Great leaders, are they born or made? 5 pages, 4 days. Undergraduate sociology, APA style, number of sources, 5. Standard quality. If you want premium quality, of course, you would have to pay more. My favorite is the book review on Are Men Necessary, which I think doesn't need anything to be written about it at all. It's a rhetorical question. Answer is no. And you can see, right, the number. When a signature pedagogy, when a field of integrative learning has become this commodified, and students are assured that they have time better spent elsewhere by the purveyors of these sites, we're in a pretty pickle. Does it mean we shouldn't write term papers anymore? No. Does it mean we should restore term papers to a larger idea about what fluency represents? Yes. And maybe we should not do it in a way that, frankly, has kind of served our purposes. I go home with stacks of papers, too. But my grading of them is very well understood by me, highly routinized, right? And I don't face difficult questions that I would face if I had to grade, let's say, a YouTube video. Not sure. And the distressing truth is, when I talk about these things, one of the first questions I will get habitually is, but how would you grade that? As if you can't figure out how to grade it, you shouldn't assign it. Maybe if you can't figure out how to grade it, that should be the assignment. Can we flip the paradigm? Can we use meta-medium fluency to get us away from signature pedagogies, tried and true, except when they're false? Signature pedagogies that scale well. Signature pedagogies that can be built reliably. Or signature pedagogies that we believe are fostering critical thinking and integrative learning, but are experienced by our students as a mild or severe form of hazing. Do you know the book Tim Clydesdale wrote called The First Year Out? It talks about students putting their identities in lockboxes their first year in college. They just have to learn life management. The rest of the time they are Clydesdale says, enduring their liberal arts hazing. Get smacked by your bio, get smacked by the psych class, get smacked by the English class. Now, that's a dire way of thinking about it. But I didn't make up the dire way of thinking about it. A sociologist did. It's distressing. And I've been in too many meetings with students where even the good ones will finally come around and say, you know, it just looked like a checklist after a while. Because it was. Can we leave behind the signature pedagogies and get to a pedagogy of signatures? Can we use metamedium fluency to help our students understand how to make the sign of the self in the human conversation by contributing something distinctive, something creative, something that speaks the self without making the self the measure of the conversation? You can't buy an authentic signature from a paper mill, if you're following my metaphor. The thing you do in a pedagogy of signatures marks who you are. Now, we believe that the term paper should do that. And probably it should at its best. But you know the arms race. They buy the papers. We put them into Turnitin.com. It's this endless, endless cycle in which everyone keeps trying to push back the notion that maybe this is just not authentic, or maybe it has become ossified. The pedagogy of signatures would be a way to encourage our students to see the work they make as a result of their education, in the process of their education, as being core to their identity, expressive of the self in a way that is a body of work. They begin as soon as they matriculate. Their life's work. What would a pedagogy of signatures look like? It might look like something we don't expect. It could look like a game. Anybody in here play Little Big Planet? Okay. Well, it's just a game. Except it isn't. Little Big Planet is a game that has within it the tools to build more levels of the game. And the game relies on physics. It relies on aesthetics. It relies on our consciousness of how to share, publish, identify, tag these works. Because you can use the game to create new levels of the game, kind of a meta-medium thing. Then you upload the levels of that game to the server the company runs, where it can be tagged, where it can be rated, where your identity is linked to the levels you make. So you want to make really cool levels because that brings you notoriety, that brings you fame. This apparently works pretty well. The game was released at the end of October 2008 in North America. 1 million user levels had been created and uploaded to the server by the end of July 2009. This is accelerating. By the end of February 2010, they were at 2 million levels. It's that exponential curve that we see when we look at something like YouTube, for example, right, or Facebook. Why? Why this creativity? Why this effort? How would you grade it? Oh, it's not graded. Well, it's graded by means of social mediation. It's graded in a way that seems to matter to the creators. And it is, I would say, a pedagogy of signatures, because what you're doing is a mark of the self in a larger conversation. And it turns out that even the U.S. Department of Education has put its seal of approval on this. I hope it doesn't kill it. But the idea is that this is an interesting platform for teaching science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Of course it is. It's a mathematical model of a world, which also looks like a cross between Sesame Street, A Renaissance Fair, Monty Python, and Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. It's okay if it's pretty and fun. You might be able to learn something as well. It could look like that. It could look like the Shorewood Lip Dub. They've got pretty good meta-medium fluency. Any of you seen the Shorewood Lip Dub? Okay, I'm going through this pretty quickly because I want some time for discussion. But if discussion flags and you want to treat, we'll look at that. If I flag, just stop me and we'll look at that. This is great fun. Obama challenged schools across the country to show why they are special. Watch our submission here. Oh. This is not a program that the school board cooked up to show President Obama why the school's in this. No. This is a class taught by a teacher at Shorewood High School. They made this as an entry in this meme that's sweeping YouTube right now, in which high schools, this is probably inspired by High School Musical, I don't know for sure, but it might be. High schools essentially do a one-take shoot, dubbing, lip-syncing to a song of the camera and students going through the whole environment of the high school, having great fun and performing. And if you want the full definition, just Google lip dub. Wikipedia will be the first link that comes up, and you can see the collaborative definition of this. This particular one is a great one for me because it's 1980s when I was actually on the air, doing crazy things as a DJ. Hall & Oates, You Make My Dreams Come True. They did it. They did it backwards. That is, the students lip-synced to the song playing backwards so that when the lip dub was shown forward, the action would be backwards but synced to the song going forwards. The thing has this astonishing, dreamlike quality. Oh, and they've had nearly a million views. And they did a making of video. And it's great. On the side, they say, ideas are already floating around for next year. Come take the class. Gosh, if classes are doing things this creative, we won't need advisors. December 17th, 2009. When Shorecrest challenged Shorewood to make a lip-dub video, they didn't know what they were getting themselves into. Ideas are already floating around for our next video. Sign up for Mr. Ballou's video production classes to take a key part in it. Honors for this video. I love some of these comments. Awesome job, you guys. Posted it to Facebook. My daughter says she hopes to be able to do something like this someday. She is in eighth grade. Okay. That works pretty well for education. All right, I'll show you this. If it gets stuck, I apologize. So, if we think media fluency, are you able to turn on a flip HD camcorder? Now, what kind of meta-medium fluency is this? How cool of an idea can you come up with? The tool use is just at the very bottom of that. What's above that is an environment in which that kind of creativity, daring, fun, and hard work are all seen as part of the same idea. How can we make something massively wonderful? It also, oddly enough, turns the entire high school into a learning environment. That's kind of interesting. If you'd like to do this yourself, sign up for Mr. Ballou's production class next year. I hear they have some ideas floating around already. Okay. The mother of all funk chords? How many of you have seen that one? Okay, good. Put it on your list. What kind of media fluency is this? Last spring, an Israeli-born musician who goes by the name of Kutiman, for a month, sat down, found completely unrelated YouTube videos in which musicians were playing things for themselves, doing instructional videos for how to drum, practicing with a theremin, practicing with two theremins, practicing the trombone with a music stand there in the room, etc. And he knit them together into a song. He actually did this for six different songs, taking completely unrelated YouTube videos and pulling them together into this marvelous synthesis he called Through You. Now, that's pretty astonishing. That idea represents medium fluency, meta-medium fluency. How would you grade it? I just want my students to be able to do this, to participate in the emergence of this new language. This is just the beginning. We're just getting started. Where will this go? I'm interested. What's holding us back? In addition to the tech churn and thinking of media fluency as, well, now we have to see if they can actually resize an image. And, right. The other thing that's holding us back, and I hate to say this, is an ugly underside to the idea of the digital native. It can get pretty ugly. I think it originated as an idea that was completely benign. In fact, I'm confident of it. The idea is, why do older folks like us, I'll speak only for myself, older folks like me, have trouble with this, whereas kids just take to it like ducks to water, which, as you know, sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. And the idea was born, right? We're digital immigrants. We did not originate in this digital country. The people who were born here, the natives, they speak the language. We have to learn it with an accent. But there's a trick to that. If you think of this not in terms of people speaking a native tongue, but in terms of relatively crude and unsophisticated people, that's where a little bit of the ugliness, potential ugliness with this metaphor, can creep in. The natives are restless, teaching strategies for today's students. It becomes an exercise in trying to reach aliens in ways that we think might please them. You know, little bits of glass and $40 worth of beads. They seem to like those things, those crazy kids. We have to do this because we have to speak to their generation. But sometimes I get the feeling that it's not quite that simple. Even when we say that with good intentions, we may mean we have to do this because they're just a bunch of folks who like cotton candy. So I guess we better have some cotton candy or they're just not going to be in our classes anymore. But secretly, down deep, we think, gosh, I wish they would just do something with print technology. That's the mark of an adult. So sometimes I think we think of digital natives as savages. Which also can let us off the hook. We can construct lip-dub opportunities for them because we hear they like to dance around. But we won't dance. We won't blog. We won't tweet. We won't edit video. Who has time for that? They have time because they're young, and it's easy to kind of resent them for that, isn't it? They don't have responsibilities. Well, I recall the responsibility of trying to grow up. That was a hard thing to do. I recall the irresponsibility of being a teenager. Those things are all in play. But there's a little bit of this underside here that you can also be a digital native by playing with these toys. Just like the natives who are savages, these media tools we have, they're just kind of hula hoops, aren't they? You know, what's all that texting about? You see the URL there? HateTexting.com. Go to that website. It's set up by somebody who really hates texting. Well, you'll have a wreck. You'll put your eye out, right? If you've seen that movie. Not only that, it's an impoverished mode of communication. It makes you stupid. You forget how to spell things. Obviously, it made the person at HateTexting.com forget how to spell things. If you look at the URL, texting each there, maybe it's a joke. It's very easy to say media fluency is about something that will help you put together a term paper or the equivalent. It's certainly not a lip dub. It's certainly not the mother of all funk chords. It's certainly not text messaging. Hula hoops as needed. And of course, there's always the opportunity for a little scolding. I own this music, so I can use clips from it in my project, right? Wrong. That frames media fluency in a way that's not very pleasant. Media fluency means you don't really want to use that media, do you? That's fraught. It's, well, it might be fair use, it might not be, but don't do that. No, don't do that. A little bit of lockdown. So, where can that lead us? Well, it leads me back to an anthropologist by the name of James Fernandez and an article called Edification by Puzzlement, in which he tries very successfully, in my view, to think about integrative learning and integrative thinking as a genre and one that some of us in a background of schooling may not recognize as quickly as we should, which means we are more likely to be insensitive to the possibilities of the meta-medium fluency I'm describing. And here's what he says. He says, beware administered intellectuality. Truly chilling phrase. Fernandez says, we should always be wary of the imperial impulse. And by we, in this case he means Western Europeans, I would say that we in education need to be aware of this too. The possibility that any interest in mentalities is betrayed by a petitio principi, a pre-existing interest in maintaining and justifying a structure of privileges. Now, this is a difficult point. I believe that long, rigorous, sustained argument is an essential part of higher education. I believe that learning to write well at length is an essential part of higher education. But I think Fernandez challenges us to be aware that a stack of papers which we are credentialed to grade can be a trap, because in the end, we might want them to do the thing that we know how to judge and administer. And when he talks about the folks he circulated among in Africa, he says that what seems to occur is that these rural uneducated subjects tend to go beyond the information given and give consideration to the context in which the question is posed. And he brings this up because it turns out that the Fang villagers were not very good with syllogisms. You know, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. The villagers would say, who is Socrates? What do you mean by mortal? They couldn't figure out that the syllogism had its own answer already there. They took it as an opportunity for thought, for inquiry. But that's not the idea. The idea is to do something else. And Fernandez warns us that this may not be the only method of thinking we should value, and that, in fact, when he quotes, go beyond the information given, he's doing a little stealth maneuver. He's actually quoting Jerome Bruner on the definition of understanding, meaning that going beyond the information given, doing something other than regurgitation, may not be the mark of someone who's uneducated. It may be the mark of someone who's been truly educated. And he talks about this in the context of riddles and says there is no single right answer to these riddles. The argument is not simply the application of a set of legal rules, but involves taking a problem situation as a personal opportunity to explore the context of the problem and its relevant precedents. This is a marvelous opportunity. It may be tough to fit it into a semester. It may be tough to fit it into a course. Courses and semesters work well for me. They may not define the learning experience. And then he gets to this analogy making, this meta thinking, this thing that I think computers can help us with, when he writes, now all analogies and riddles are analogies par excellence, have the capacity to establish or suggest connections between experiences within domains and between domains. They are cognitively integrating analogies, riddles, lip dubs, mother of all funk chords, maybe. This is basically what I mean by edification, Fernandez writes, the cognitive construction by suggestion of a larger integration of things, a larger whole. And Hofstetter echoes this when he writes that pattern finding is the core of intelligence, analogy making lies at the heart of intelligence. And my claim is that the computer as a metamedium, if we can think about metamedium fluency, can get us to a richer experience of pattern finding, analogy making, and integrative thinking, because it's just a brain we've designed for ourselves outside of the one we use that we can interact with. So, now comes the part where you're going to have to help out. I want to think about two ways in which this kind of integrative thinking, this kind of medium or metamedium fluency, might be able to help us prepare our students for life in this digital world. One is the idea of the long tail. You've seen the idea of the long tail. You know how that goes, right? And the optical trick here, you can't see because the color on the projector's erasing it. But this part is actually a different color from the long tail part. It looks like a bigger deal here, but actually the area here is the same as the area there. It amounts to the same thing. Now, why does this matter? Amazon.com's Josh Peterson describes it as, we sold more books today that didn't sell at all yesterday than we sold today of all the books that did sell yesterday, which is a funny way of saying, don't underestimate the value and importance of astonishing diversity. Ubiquitous niches. Work that may seem not generally applicable at any given point, or may seem completely idiosyncratic, like a lip dub. But over time, turns out to have tremendous value because of this long tail. Another example from Chris Anderson's blog is the long tail of airplane travel. All right? Lowered flight costs, more travel, more risk-taking, lower search costs, you get off the beaten path, better word-of-mouth tools, it's a bottoms-up hit, it becomes grassroots, peer ratings and reviews reinforce authentic success and punish manufactured experience. This phenomenon will happen in education. It will happen in higher education. It's part of what it means to live in a digital world. These small one-offs become massively important over time. So the question is, how can we equip our students as they make things out of their medium or meta-medium fluency to take advantage of the long tail, to make work that will persist, be able to be viewed, be able to matter over a long time, from the very beginning of their college career? This is the chart that shows you how it worked. You can actually see that the top destinations begin to decline in importance, and the diversity, the varied, off-the-beaten-path destinations begin to increase over time. It's okay with me if students construct things that are off-the-beaten-path, because off-the-beaten-path will eventually matter to a lot of people. So, item one, it's a long-tail world. Education is a manifestation going forward of this long-tail phenomenon. How can we equip our students to use medium fluency or meta-medium fluency to understand the value of the individual work they do? Question one. Question two is an analogous question, and it's born of a misspelling that happened when someone was kind enough to comment on one of my podcasts. The person was transcribing from what I had said and wrote down not long T-A-I-L, but long T-A-L-E. That's a phenomenon we should equip our students to take advantage of as well. Whereas the T-A-I-L is about individuation, flourishing in diversity, let a thousand flowers bloom. The long T-A-L-E is how to situate your story within the story of humanity. One we can trace back tens of thousands of years to the cave paintings in Altamira, Spain. Our students do not believe that they are writing part of that story. They believe they are writing papers for us to grade. And I have to fight with all my might to push back against that and say, no, this is your life's work, which matters in the sense of our work together. It's something you're constructing for the long tail, T-A-I-L, of your own work going forward, and something that belongs to the story we write together as part of the human conversation. Media fluency, which you can see here in the cave paintings, is part of that. In a new media faculty development seminar that I'm facilitating at Baylor right now, just a couple of days ago, we were looking at video art by an artist named Bill Viola, who really is an astonishingly creative and profound artist, I believe. And as we were talking about Viola's work, a fellow in the religion department who talks about religion and media and thinks about religion and media, that's his specialty, came up with something that just astonished me and led to the long T-A-L-E part of what I wanted to share with you today. He said, in a world of information abundance, perhaps we won't be crushed. Perhaps what will happen in a world of information abundance, he said, is that as never before, we will be able to store and share this immense social archive in an act of stewardship for the other. It won't be that we won't have a place for what this person who does something I couldn't imagine doing has created and shared, We have a place for everything now, and tools with which to find those things. Nothing need be lost in a world of potentially infinite storage, and it's getting cheaper all the time. We will be able together to become stewards of each other. Which leads to the last example. Carl Sagan's A Glorious Dawn. Have any of you seen this video? This too is meta-medium fluency. What this person has done in an effort to bring a storytelling and mystical element to science is to take clips from Cosmos and also a couple of clips from, I believe, A Brief History of Time with Stephen Hawking and make a song out of it by feeding the voices through an auto-tuner. You can get one for the iPhone called IMT Pain. It costs $2.99. And he weaves together, out of words about the universe, a song that we don't even know we're singing together. A song that begins with the song of a whale and goes from there to Carl Sagan singing, but he didn't do that originally. He is here. If you want to bake an apple pie from scratch, first you must invent the universe. If this meta-medium fluency can bring that kind of consciousness to our students, I think we'll have done something worth doing. So, let me put it to you now. Think about the long tail, diversity, niches, no small thing unimportant. How can we equip our students to be users and constructors of knowledge in that world? How can we do it in a world in which we're weaving the tail together, the world of the long T-A-L-E? I know those are big questions, so just start anywhere. What can we do? How can we help? How many people in the library here? Okay. How many people, EdTech, support staff of some kind? How many faculty? Any CIOs in the house? A couple of them. Oh, several. Okay, good. Well, let's start with the CIOs. You're the decision makers, right? If you all get it right, the librarians and the EdTech and the faculty and all the rest of them, we'll be fine, right? Okay. What do you think? How can we equip our students with a meta-medium fluency, with this kind of headgear? What can you do? Yep. Well, let me see if I can get at that. The first thing to say is, of course, it's a metaphor, right? But let's literalize it, because your question's intriguing. Why did he practice so? Why did this matter to him? It didn't matter to all the signers. Not all of them signed so distinctively. Why was this something that would be at all important to him? It's a mark of the self that identifies the self. I don't think in just a self-indulgent way, but maybe. I mean, who knows? I don't know John. But I would like to think of it as a mark of the self that took a certain rigor and discipline to master and a certain knowledge of when that would matter. Now, here's how I see it fitting in with the media fluency or the medium fluency I'm trying to describe. If our students believe that what they construct for us as representations of their own learning can be something other than a one-to-one correspondence with what we have told them to learn or items we have asked them to memorize, important as they are, if they can think of the work they do for us as work they could do with a flourish, and I don't mean a flourish that we've told them about, but a flourish they may have invented and mastered on their own, then that work has a chance of being, it seems to me, meaningful. Not just for them, but meaningful going forward. Because what we'll end up with is not a whole set of things that you might as well just buy online, but things that will matter, perhaps even matter to them. I don't know that they believe, these 18-year-olds we welcome into our traditional schools, I don't know that they believe that they could have ideas when they're 18 that will be useful to them for the rest of their lives and they might want to be working on, but I believe it. I know it for a fact. In some respects, they are more likely to have certain kinds of disruptive ideas then they will be 10 or 20 years later. So I want them to have these tools and have the tools and the facility with the tools matter to them at a conceptual level so that they can believe they can make something that's expressive with a flourish that they should keep track of, that they shouldn't let go. And I link that to, fancifully, because I haven't interviewed him, what John Hancock was thinking of when he affixed his signature with such a flourish to this document. I don't want to say that the people who didn't sign the way John Hancock signed were somehow not as thoughtful about what they were signing or who they were. There's a distinctiveness, it seems to me, about that signature, which is boldly evident, but I would say it inheres in all the signatories of the document if they're thinking about what they were doing. The larger point I'm trying to make has to do with whether one believes this is somehow authentically connected with the self, that this is a sign of the self, somehow, in a way that's not self-indulgent or just about, Kilroy was here, but something that matters more, something that feels important in a way that's arguing for commitment and engagement. This one's easy to see, and he's become a byword for signatures. But I take your point. There's a balance here. There's this sense that 40, 50 years ago, students could really write. That's when they really did their homework and respected us and were, we know that's not true. So I don't think that we're looking at, and I've been at this 20 years, I don't see that massive slippage. I don't. But let me try to get at this at a bigger level. Yes, all of these things will need to be taught, mastered. They'll all have to be in the conversation going forward. Yes, some students don't write very well. It is possible that a new fluency will erode an old fluency. I am not a really big oral culture guy myself. I'm not as good at it as I would be if I didn't know how to write. Socrates was worried about that. He was probably right to worry. I don't have the memory I would have had if I didn't have writing. There are trade-offs there, admittedly. I would like to see writing stay vigorous. I don't want it to go away. I think there's peculiar value in it. That said, there's also a trick there. Our students tend to get pretty good practice in writing before they get to us, but it's not always really good practice in good writing. And I found something out that startled me. The first indication I had of it was that many students wrote better on exams than they did in their term papers. Completely counterintuitive. They didn't have as much time to kind of fiddle around with all the forms they thought they ought to use. Then I found out that if I told them to post their papers to their blogs, but write in their blogging voice, that they would tend to write better on their blogs. Now, not all the words would be spelled correctly. I understand that, and that's important. They wouldn't always write in complete sentences. But if they were using sentence fragments that were actually appropriately used and vigorous, they were better for me to read than really windy and dry sentences. And people who've worked in English studies know that standards, not standards in terms of elegance and expressiveness, but in terms of spelling, in terms of what constitutes a good sentence, they've changed over the years. One year it's Hemingway, next year it's not. So it's a complicated question. I think students get inhibited in their term papers and can write in very crabbed ways. And there are ways in which some of these multi or meta media will free them. We'll have to maintain rigor. We absolutely will. My caution is that rigor doesn't mean just do what I know how to do, because that's not going to get us very far. It just isn't. I would add to that that media not only record what you've thought, but they actually further the ability to think. And writing helps you think in certain ways. They're not the only ways. They tend to get privileged. They shouldn't go away. But I'd like to see some other media in there as well. Faculty will also push back because they do not have time to learn how to do or evaluate things in these other media. This is what will be said. And on one level, I get that. On another level, it really doesn't matter. The world is going to go forward. I hope it's in a good direction. I would like my colleagues, because they're very smart, creative people, to be able to have some shaping or guiding influence in the way we think about these things. But these additional media are not going away, and we have to be able to work with them somehow. And also, just not fob them off on the EdTech folks. Or, you know what I mean? It has to be integrated. It can't be, yes, I think you should know how to do something with video. Go to the video center. Huh? Then there's a clear message. I think you should do this, but I don't think I should do it. Therefore, it's not really important, but you need to go do it. If you're going to be an intellectual, you need to come to grips with these things, it seems to me. Yeah?
In your institution or the course of places where you go and talk, particularly to faculty, how much or to what degree do you get a pushback of sort of kind of a tangent to what you guys are talking about, of seeing anything besides writing as a post-college vocational skill, where writing, like the systems of thought that get taught to writing can then be applied to this media, because you can just go like apply it to this world, you know, go to community college afterwards if you want to learn how CAD works kind of mentality.
Yeah, that's a... Yeah, I mean, there is... One of the nice things about new media, in my experience, and the new media reader is essential reading along these lines. In there, the writers say, new media offers us an opportunity for making... for uniting making and knowing, that making something is a mode of knowing it. And that is tough a lot of times because faculty believe that being able to write well means that they're not getting their hands dirty. Whereas being out in the field or shooting something, you know, with a video camera, that really is more like what we pay other people to do. And there's a long history of that. Executives didn't used to type. I guess some of them still don't, but I guess most executives know how to type, right? It used to be kings were not literate. You know this, right? Kings would refuse to learn to read and write, because that's what the clerks did, the clerks, right? Yes, if only the kings had been literate, maybe they would have been a little more thoughtful about the whole the king thing. Yeah, there is a generational divide here. Younger colleagues take more of it for granted and have a little more facility, I think. But the meta medium level, I mean, that's at the level of curriculum. It's not just at the level of were you able to embed an image. And that's a challenge. That's a real challenge. And, I mean, how many of you have writing across the curriculum programs in your schools? Okay. How many of you have speaking across the curriculum? Okay. A few people, but fewer. New media across the curriculum, it seems to me, is the next logical step. But that's really tough. And in part, it's tough because it's no part of graduate education right now. And faculty are the products of graduate education. Yes, we are. Yeah?
And I'm going to answer it in a very personal way because it's the only way I can answer it, which is to be a disruptive force in my own work. And by disruptive, I mean by continuing to ask questions and probe deeper the answers that I'm given and to challenge the things that I'm told. I think that's front and center to what I can do.
Thank you. Everybody hear that? It's no fun most of the time. I mean, we all like comfort zones. That's why they call it comfort zones. I mean, me too, right? But the thing, you know what gets me even more than, I mean, I like thinking about the ideas. I see something like the Shorewood Lip Dub, and I'm thinking, I want to play with them. I want to be part of whatever a teacher or a support staff or a building custodian or whatever can do to make more of that possible. That's amazing stuff. And they write pretty well, putting it up on YouTube. There was a lot of writing in the video, not sustained, rigorous thought, not a dissertation. It's true. But I mean, there's a wonderful kind of symbiosis that can happen there. And, you know, to have students say, got any ideas? We're already thinking about this. Sign up for the class next time. That's just astonishing. And that's a wonderful thing. So, yes, I thank you for that. Yeah. Well, nobody has spotted the error in the slide yet. Thank you. You see, I'm so hung up on YouTube that I've forgotten to count to three. One, two. Here's the third one, and it comes from the nightly summit I attended a couple of years ago. And it was the first thing that popped into my head when I was thinking about preparing for this, when I was invited to come. Were you here, any of you, when Mike Wesch spoke? Do you remember the question after, and he's aces, right? He's one of the gold standards for all of this. And there's nothing like blogging about James Fernandez and getting Mike Wesch to leave a comment on your blog. That's a nice thing. Someone in the audience, maybe somebody in this room now, at the end of this amazing, inspiring speech, raised his hand and said, "What can we do to help? How can we help you?" Do you remember what Mike Wesch said? Get out of the way. Get out of my way. Hardest thing for a caregiver to hear. Hard thing for a parent to hear. But that's the third question, which is, how can we, and that could be you as a faculty member, you as a CIO, you as an ed tech person, you as a librarian, how can you get out of the way? Not that you're not going to offer any aid, but what have we done that has wittingly or unwittingly placed obstacles in the path of the kinds of innovation I'm describing? And it can be any number of things. It can be systems that will not adapt, that are completely closed, and that's what you get. It can be what I call very facetiously 10 steps to know, which is the IT interview from hell, in which you sit down with a well-meaning person who asks you 10 questions about what you want to do, trying very hard to find out what it really is they can say no to, finally, tracing your ambition through 10 steps until it's just out of the question. You know, it could be anything. What are we doing that puts things in the way? Single sign-on as a holy grail for the student computing experience? That can get in the way. I mean, what else? What else can get in the way? How can we get out of the way? And that doesn't mean that everything they do is automatically valid. It doesn't mean that, right. But it's hard not to rush to that judgment, especially because it just doesn't look like anything we do, right? Well, I recall playing Jethro Tull at high volumes. My parents were really puzzled by that. They couldn't hear the shape or the melody in the music. I mean, they literally couldn't hear it. And now Tull sounds like the London Symphony Orchestra, you know, compared to whatever it is these crazy kids are listening to today, et cetera, right?
That's actually a good moment. And we're a bit over time, I just want to say it's a great time. Let me first ask if you could thank Gardner for his really exciting...
Thank you.